I'm George Liston, CA. From the end of the Civil War to the beginning of the Civil Rights Crusade, a century later, African Americans endured a brutal regime of oppression. It was called segregation, and it was imposed on its victims by legal code, social custom, and outright violence. More than anything else, it was an assault on a person's dignity and self-worth, meant to be endured in silence. While it was endured, it was never accepted, and the voices that were muted then are finding full expression now, and through remembered pain, adding a vital chapter to the history of the nation. My guest is Raymond Gavins, professor of history at Duke University, where he is co-director of Behind the Veil, documenting African-American life in the Jim Crow South. Raymond Gavins, welcome to Dialogue.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
It's a pleasure. As I said in the introduction, from Reconstruction to the Voting Rights Act of 1965, segregation was a very hard fact of life for black Americans, southern black Americans in particular. As an historian, in the context of Behind the Veil, an oral history project, what are you seeking to achieve through this project? What do you want the project to do?
What we want to do is to create a history, construct a history of African Americans using African American voices and African American sources with the purpose of establishing how African Americans lived, how they survived, and how they struggled through these generations between the two reconstructions, as you have so nicely framed them.
What is the scope of it? Will it cover the entire South, or will you focus, for example, on North Carolina, where, of course, Duke University is in your space?
My own monograph, the book project that I am completing now, focuses on North Carolina. We have done a more general book covering these voices for the entire region. What we expect to do in the next stage is a more general history of the South, of the Black South in this period, together with smaller scale projects focusing on regions of the South as well as on individual states.
So this is going to be a very comprehensive
and ongoing.
Ongoing as well.
And ongoing.
One of the remarkable aspects of it I'd like to bring forth right now, and that is the fact, to my mind, Dr. Gavins, the voices that we hear are certainly eloquent voices, but correct me if I'm wrong, they're largely the voices of people we might call otherwise anonymous. These are not the voices of elite leaders, so to speak, of the movement at any stage, at least in what I heard. First of all, is that true? And if so, is that part of the meaning of this project?
It is part of the meaning of the project. It is part of the design of the project. Mm-hmm. To go after a larger cast of African-American characters over these largely understudied generations so that we can understand the masses of people who were struggling at the time, for example, that Booker T. Washington and W.E.B. Du Bois were the great voices of the race. What we attempt to do is to provide an understanding of African-American life that involves working class people, ordinary people. Mm-hmm. They made up the great mass of African-Americans behind the veil.
Yeah, this is, to me, it strikes me as extremely important in and of itself. And I guess I'm compelled to ask you this question. As an historian, is it also my further understanding that these voices, the sheer power, if you will, of these mass voices had its own kind of influence on the direction of the movement, on the ideology, on the tactics and everything else?
Absolutely. Uh-huh. Absolutely. Because you don't begin to understand Afro-American ideology and strategy unless you understand the role of the African-American churches, African-American schools, African-American fraternal lodges, women's organizations. These workers, these voices mm-hmm. were very, very influential in determining the priorities of right. the race.
We're going to come to focus on them very specifically in the course of this conversation, because I think it is a vitally important thing for us all to understand how they contributed. You mentioned Du Bois, W.E.B. Du Bois, and I'm tempted to bring him into our conversation at this point, and with this particular question, which may be an impossible one, actually. But he's, among his many eloquent writings, he's famous for talking about Black Americans harboring two souls in one body, the divided existence that was compelled by the very facts of bigotry, segregation, so forth. And I guess the question is this, Dr. Gavins, as you listen to these voices, conduct this research, the people, the men and women whose voices we hear, were clearly, I would think, struggling with their very notion of citizenship.
They were.
I mean, what can it mean to be a citizen of a place that's denying your very humanity?
Right, right.
I guess, first of all, is that the fact? And what kind of notions would they come up with?
It is the fact. And Du Bois was very much a product of that first generation coming out of slavery who longed for American citizenship, mm-hmm. who wanted to reconcile the two-ness, so to speak, being an American, being a Negro. That's how Du Bois put it. Mm-hmm. Because his own education as a young man was received in the South,
right.
In the heart of the Black Belt in Tennessee. And his classmates, most of them were ex-slaves. This is where he learned the Black spiritual. He learned the importance of that depth of expression that he brought to bear in his classic book, The Souls of Black Folk.
Right.
It was a distillation of the aspirations of that generation. Mm-hmm. And he is, incidentally, the architect of the metaphor of the veil.
Oh, really? That part I didn't know.
Yes, he is.
Uh-huh. How did he use it?
He used it as a way of saying that the African-American was only half free and that the African-American longed for self-conscious, for full manhood, for full acceptance into the American Citizenship Project, and that he would not be at rest, he would not be at peace until he had achieved it.
That's really striking. I didn't know that was the origin of the title.
Yes,
really.
Yes, the whole notion of the veil as a metaphor for uh-huh. segregation is an invention of W.E.B. Du Bois.
And would you say that the aspiration which you've just recounted, which he expressed, is reflected in the lives, the voices that we hear here? Is it an undercurrent or even a more pronounced aspect?
The vision of freedom, mm-hmm. of becoming fully free, mm-hmm. Was something that African Americans anticipated, expected, struggled for coming out of slavery. It was built into their institutions, and they passed it on to each generation.
Right.
Now, the forms of that project shifted over time, but it's interesting to note that the generation coming out of Reconstruction had clung to the 14th and 15th Amendments. Mm-hmm. And a century later, Thurgood Marshall and others out of Howard Law School had argued
That's right.
along those same lines. Mm-hmm. So I think one of the things we are trying to do is to understand that African Americans transmit mm-hmm. those aspirations of a generation.
You're making me understand a word you use in the course of this now, agency.
Agency.
That they were active in their own behalf.
They were.
Much of the work that you have done in connection with this project and with other things that you have focused on as an historian concerns the reality of North Carolina.
Yes.
As one part of the entire story, one very important part of the Southern story as well. And there's a very pivotal event in the history of North Carolina that takes place at the end of the 19th century in the city of Wilmington, a very ugly riot. All riots are ugly, but this one, of course, exceptionally so. The violence of that riot cost many Black lives and sent a great many other Blacks into exile in a
yes.
city in which I think they had been an extremely prominent, if not dominant, part of the population.
They were.
I'd like you to tell us a little bit about that, because I want to focus on this particular incident and in fact, later, listen a little bit of a historical recounting of it. Was it a turning point? I mean, how would you describe the event itself and what it meant to black history?
Okay. The Wilmington riot is certainly a watershed in many ways, both in terms of Southern history as a whole, but particularly in terms of North Carolina history, because it culminates the white backlash against African-American agency, against African-American political power in particular, which continued to be influential in North Carolina in the eastern part of the state, in the eastern district of the state. The Republicans and African-Americans and populists were very, very strong in this area. Mm-hmm. In order to break that stranglehold at the end of the 19th century, North Carolina Democrats put together something that they called a white supremacy campaign. Mm-hmm. And that was designed to rid the state once and for all of black political influence and also of grassroots democracy. Mm-hmm. of public education, for example, for black people and for poor people.
Yeah.
For black North Carolina as a whole, the Wilmington riot was an hourglass because not only because of disfranchisement, but because the memory of Wilmington set the stage for the ways in which African Americans went about rebuilding their communities. They went about reminding themselves that they had a common struggle. Many of the people who went into exile from Wilmington that you referred to went to other parts of the state.
Mm-hmm.
Many of them came to Washington, D.C. Many of them went north to other places. But they carried with them the notion that they had to continue to struggle.
Mm.
Black Wilmington rebuilt, put together its core institutions in the wake of the riot. This tradition, especially carried by the black press, was carried all over the state of North Carolina. There was always, remember Wilmington.
Mm.
There was always a sense in which the Wilmington riot became a metaphor for the struggle that must continue.
A seminal event in every way.
It was a seminal event.
Mm. When I think of the larger phenomena of which all of this, of which we're speaking, is a part, I was struck by an observation you quote in your writings. It's drawn from the work of Haynes Walton, Jr., a political scientist, and the quote reads, "Black politics is a function of the particular brand of segregation in which black people find themselves." I was struck by that. And I therefore I pose it to you in this sense as a question. What does that mean about the kind of narratives that you discover throughout the South and perhaps elsewhere in the country? I'm sure it's a vast kind of topic to address, but if you were to comment on that even briefly, what would you say?
I think what Professor Walton is pointing out and what I agree with is that you don't begin to understand what black people are doing politically unless you understand where they are and how they understand their situation, you see. And this is why you can't always simply apply some classic political narrative to black people based on the struggles of other working class peoples or other subjugated peoples, whether they are peasants or people who are victimized by caste systems. You have to look at the particularities of black life under segregation, and you have to look at the ways in which African Americans appropriated that situation. I think that's how we can understand Booker T. Washington. That's how we understand a Du Bois. That's how we understand an A. Philip Randolph.
Right.
You say.
You know, and that strikes me, actually, I hadn't anticipated this, but that also would seem to me to be at the very heart of the Oral History Project, because that is about what you thought, where you knew you were and what you thought about it, what you intended to do.
Sure.
It requires that kind of testimony.
Right, and the kinds of strategies that African Americans developed to cope as well as to resist leads us away. Looking at the context can lead us away from slipshod notions that they should have done this or they should have done that. Mm-hmm. Because when you look at the political context of segregation, or when you look at the threat of violence, you have to consider how African Americans appropriated that situation.
Right.
It was always important to be able to transmit that to the next generation and have someone survive to tell about it.
Right. Let me take a moment from our conversation, Dr. Gavins, just to say that this is Dialogue, a presentation of the Woodrow Wilson Center. I'm George Liston, CA, and my guest is Raymond Gavins, professor of history at Duke University. Dr. Gavins, you mentioned earlier, and I want to come back to it now, the role of institutions like the church, professions like teachers and organizations like the NAACP. In the context of this kind of research, of the, shall we say, the power of it coming up through mass voices, how did that influence these kinds of organizations? And then what did they do as a result of that?
Right. That's a superb question, because it's one that I'm trying to answer in my own book on North Carolina. Without sort of understanding that organizations like the NAACP had strong affiliations in North Carolina. Mm-hmm. And in North Carolina communities, the NAACP chapter worked in close contact with churches, with Masonic lodges, schools, and other local institutions. And what often happens is that in these communities, working class people take charge of these organizations. It's one thing to look at the national office of the NAACP, but when it comes to Eastern North Carolina, the NAACP becomes really very much owned by the people who are looking for jobs, who are trying to protect themselves, who are looking for justice in everyday situations. Mm-hmm. And so what we get here is a much more community-based NAACP,
right.
A much more community-based urban league. Mm-hmm. These are not just abstractions anymore. Mm-hmm. The church is not just some state conference. It's not just an abstraction, but it's a living, acting institution.
Right.
And it seems to me that organizations are a key to sort of understanding how people gave meaning to their lives,
right.
And how they kept alive a common struggle.
And also reminding us that history, and this history in particular, is not solely an elite or leadership phenomenon. It's a product of the passions of many, many people. I think it's time now, with your permission and your help, to listen to a voice and to hear your comment on it. I've selected from the work that you've done a man named William Childs, I think, and because it does relate to Wilmington as well. So let's listen to a moment or two and then just get your reaction on what we've heard.
When you were a child and you knew your grandmother, did your grandmother talk to you about the past and her life?
Well, she talked. It was a close family. They were all around and that kind of thing. Yeah. They talked about occurrences. They did not really want to talk too much about the riot of 1898. They did not like to talk too much about that. There was of course, they had a lot of information about it, but they did not like to talk about it. Back then, when I was coming along, there was what they called grown folks talk and children's talk. And there were certain things that grown folks talked about that they didn't want the children to be hearing and talking about. Do you understand what I'm talking about? Yeah. So we got some of those things by possibly accident, overhearing, and that kind of thing. And of course they were, shall I say, positive people. They looked forward rather than but. And very little about 1898, very little did I ever get from my grandparents or anything like that. They did not talk to us about those things. I do know that on the street where she lived lived also about in the middle of the block a man who held a pretty important position in the city. I'm not too sure whether he was a police officer. I think he must have been prior to the riots. Oh, yes. Yes.
So when did you first, do you remember when you first started knowing that the riot had occurred in 1898?
I did not really know until I started going to school. It was as I later learned, it was a real traumatic kind of thing, and many blacks who lived through that era were quieted. They were not expected to talk too much about it. As you probably have read, a lot of blacks were driven.
Well, tell us about that. I mean, I was struck by several things. The fact that it was obviously a powerful subject, and he talked about the adults' talk and so forth. What do you make of that?
Right.
He raised?
One of the titles that I use for a piece that I did on the Wilmington riot was something called Fear, Then Hope, and Struggle. There was a tradition of fear. It cannot be denied because after the pogrom, after the massacre, there were many who left, more than 3,000 who left, and they carried that horror with them. So there was a tradition of fear. Many of the locals who remained, as his grandmother and father did, both ex-slaves, incidentally, and he grew up in a household in which he was in direct line of the values coming from a grandmother and a grandfather who were ex-slaves. Many of them were silenced by that fear and didn't want their children or grandchildren to directly challenge white supremacy, fearing lynchings and unexplained killings. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, that fear also coincided with hope and struggle. So whereas he did not get a whole lot about the riot itself from his grandparents, he heard a lot at school.
Mm-hmm.
And he also heard a lot from this minstrel man who lived in the neighborhood, who was an eyewitness to many of the killings. So there were ways, in other words, there were channels of communication. There were sources of information that people in the community could transmit
right.
To young people, and he ultimately did receive that.
And, you know, this is suggestive of the power of these kinds of narratives. And from your comment on it, I have a sense of something that's so deeply woven into the lives of all those affected. And, for example, learning that his parents had been ex-slaves, and their fears, of course, were conditioned by that experience. By the time he got to school, it was already part of the environment, the
right.
environmental knowledge he
right.
grew up with.
Right. His own father was a train car cook, but he and three of his brothers were college graduates. And that was because it was so important. This tradition of learning in his household was very important for a man who was cooking on a train car, wanted to make sure his children went to school, you
right.
see. And those are values that African Americans retained from generation to generation.
Raymond Gavins, thanks to you, we've met William Childs, and through the project, literally thousands of other people whose voices to this point have not been heard. And I think people listening can sense, even from this very brief moment that we've heard this, the power of this kind of narrative, which I guess leads to the concluding question for this conversation. As an historian, when you have done something like this or continue to do it, and we you know far better than I do or anyone else what history means, what particular contribution, where is this going to fit, what's it going to tell, how should it be placed, and what should everyone who considers himself an American come to understand through this?
For the South as a whole, I would say that I think the ideal, and of course the scholarly motivation behind this project is to not only write a better narrative of Southern history, particularly in the post-emancipation period from the end of slavery to the Voting Rights Act, mm-hmm. To get a sense that the South became a new South or became a more democratic South because African Americans were major contributors to making it that way. Through their suffering, through their sacrifices, they were not just one-dimensional historical characters who were oppressed. They were also challenging power to become fairer and more democratic. Martin Luther King Jr. came out of this tradition. Mm-hmm. We don't get a king without the institutions like Morehouse and those colleges and universities and churches that were so important. So we want to understand that. In the case of North Carolina, I have tried to make it more particular in terms of understanding how modern North Carolina is created in the first half right. of the 20th century. Mm-hmm. Without African Americans contributing to the economy, contributing to civic democracy, you don't get a new North Carolina.
Well said. And once again, as we conclude, the word agency
yes.
this comes back to my mind. Thank you so much, Dr. Gavins.
Well, thank you for having me.
I thoroughly enjoyed it. You have been listening to Dialogue. My guest today was Raymond Gavins, professor of history at Duke University. I'm George Liston C.A., producer and host of Dialogue. Our technical director is John Tyler. Our production engineer is Anthony Barber. And our associate producer is Rachel Edmonds. Dialogue is a production of the Woodrow Wilson International Center for Scholars. Established by Congress in 1968, the center is our nation's official and living memorial to the 28th President of the United States, Woodrow Wilson.